Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll hear what happened to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which has not had a budget since October. Then we'll consider life in its various forms. We'll look at the dramatic decline in amphibian populations. Scientists have wondered what could be the cause, and now they may have some answers. Mountain lions are a source of controversy in California, where voters will decide in March whether to change their protected status. We'll hear two people from opposite sides of the issue lock horns. And our Earth calendar explores how some creatures deal with life in the winter, like frogs that make antifreeze for their own bodies. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Last summer, the President requested Congress to appropriate $7.4 billion to fund the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which is charged with the responsibility of protecting the nation's environment and health. Instead, the Congress passed a bill imposing a number of restrictions on EPA's activities and appropriating nearly a quarter less than the President had asked for and 14% less than had been appropriated the year before. Clinton vetoed the bill. Fred Hansen, Deputy Administrator of the EPA, describes what is happening at the agency, which has now gone almost 4 months without a budget.
Well, the status is that we are operating under the third continuing resolution so far this fiscal year, that is, since October 1st. In addition, we have had in that same period 4 weeks of time when the government has been shut down because the Congress was not willing to be able to appropriate dollars to operate the Environmental Protection Agency as well as other departments and agencies within the government. In addition to that, we are operating at this continuing resolution, as in the last two, at a level that is about 34% below what the President had asked for and believes is essential for us to be able to properly protect public health and the environment.
And what has happened to the efforts to clean up toxic wastes or the program affectionately known as the Superfund program?
Well, that's probably one of the places that more disruptions than ever have occurred, which are ensuring that cleanups are not going ahead as well and as fast as they should. First off, at the reduced funding level, we are not able to move as many cleanups along as we would have under the President's request. And that reduction is obviously affecting both the rate and the number of cleanups. But more importantly, when we have gone through shutdowns, it is also dramatically disrupting the cleanup activities, missing critical cleanup activities that could be occurring, as well as costing substantially more money.
Fred Hansen is the Deputy Administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Some scientists say that many species of animals and plants alive today may not survive the next century. The list of species threatened with extinction ranges from the tiny Knowlton cactus to the giant grizzly bear. But among all animals and plants, amphibians appear to be doing the worst. The reasons behind this decline are not fully understood, but new research has shed some light. As Thomas Lally reports, the poor health of amphibians may mirror the health of the planet as a whole.
All around the world, amphibians are dying. Apparently, it's been going on for the past 20 years or so, but scientists only recently realized that this is a global phenomenon. Ron Heyer is a curator at the Smithsonian Institution and chairs the Declining Amphibian Population Task Force. He says scientists are still trying to get a handle on the situation.
We're still at the stage where we're finding out exactly what's going on a worldwide basis. But what we really have found out since there's been a lot of people focused on the problem is that there is a definable problem that's occurring in some areas of the world. And that was not firmly established back in the 70s and 80s when it was first being discussed as a possible problem.
Heyer says more research is needed since most amphibian species have never even been counted. Determining the cause of the decline is also a giant task. Researchers at the University of California at Santa Cruz discovered recently that frog eggs were damaged when they combined two factors that alone had only a negligible effect. One factor was UVB radiation, which has been increased due to ozone depletion. The other factor was acidic water, which has been increased in the environment from acid rain. Lorelei Saylor worked on the study and says the two factors are common features in many areas of the world today.
Our results indicate that neither pH nor UVB alone had a significant effect. However, when they were combined, there was a significant synergistic interaction between the two.
Saylor says the discovery that two factors combined do more harm than if they acted alone signifies that scientists aren't likely to pinpoint a so-called smoking gun. In other words, there are probably many factors working together causing the decline in amphibian populations, and that probably means we're decades away from finding a solution. Andrew Blaustein is a researcher at Oregon State University. He, too, worked on the UC Santa Cruz study in addition to his own work, which found that increased UV radiation made some frog species more susceptible to disease. He says we should pay attention to what is happening to amphibians.
In some cases, amphibians are an indicator species under certain circumstances, a good biological indicators of environmental stress. They have been likened to a canary in a coal mine where they don't have any hair or feathers. They have very permeable skin, and they can absorb contaminants very nicely, whereas some other organisms may not do this in certain circumstances. They can be used as bioindicators of certain environmental stresses.
If the global die-off of amphibians is a warning, it should also signal that human understanding of the environment only goes so far. Lorelei Saylor says the results suggest that science is still far away from understanding the mysteries of the natural world.
We need to continue to deepen our understanding of the complexity of natural systems. And it won't come easily, but we must continue to keep on trying. And the lesson, I guess, to be learned is that that things aren't going to be as easy to explain as maybe we at first hoped. And it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to understand natural systems and how all the different effects you can think of that occur in a particular natural setting might be working together to affect living organisms.
Scientists say reversing the decline in amphibian populations will not be easy. They say the environment has already been significantly altered, and some amphibians may not be able to adapt quickly enough. Andrew Blaustein says his research showing that UV radiation diminishes the immune system of some frogs may be helpful in saving some species, but extreme measures might have to be taken in some cases.
For some of the species, we think they're in pretty big trouble here. There are some areas of California, some areas in Oregon, and some areas all over the world where amphibians are, where we're going to lose some species, no doubt about it. In other cases, we may actually be able to help these organisms out, and what we're doing in our lab is looking at the molecular basis for why the eggs and embryos are damaged by UV light. We're doing this in conjunction with some scientists in agricultural chemistry department here, and we've already shown that some species have a better ability to repair their DNA that is damaged by UV, and possibly, and this is just far out right now, we can genetically engineer some species to be able to better cope with the DNA damage that occurs.
Some may question whether amphibians are worth such an effort. But Blaustein points out that amphibians play a major role in many ecosystems. They eat prolific amounts of insects and are themselves a significant source of food for many other species. But Ron Heyer says there are other reasons why amphibians should be valued.
From my own perspective, I study amphibians, and the reason that I really like amphibians and appreciate them is just because they are such magnificent creatures. To go out and see them alive, to hear them, to watch them, to listen to them, it's just amazing. They're marvelous creatures in their own right. Even the not-so-beautiful organisms have just fantastic life cycles, some of the most diverse reproductive strategies and for vertebrates in particular. And we just want to make sure that these marvelous organisms are still around for our children and grandchildren.
Reversing the amphibian decline will likely require difficult choices, from restricting habitat destruction to cutting our use of ozone-depleting gases. Stephen Kellert is a professor at Yale University and author of the book The Value of Life. He argues that it's in our own best interest to preserve biodiversity, the variation of living species on Earth.
Just as we would greatly diminish our capacity to physically thrive and survive, I think we would also greatly diminish our intellectual and emotional capacity to live lives replete with meaning and significance. We can, even our successful machine-created products which provide people with opportunities for emotional and intellectual growth, even those depend very much on nature as a model, as a design model, and as something to mimic. If we were to eliminate those models, we would have, in all likelihood, an impoverished psychological self as well as a diminished material one.
Numerous research projects around the world are concentrating on assessing the health of specific amphibian populations. But scientists say species are dying off before they can be studied. In one case, a species in Australia was being studied because scientists thought they may hold answers for treatment of ulcers. But they died off, and the research ended. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. Humans have designed a lot of instruments to manage the lives of other creatures. In California, they use the ballot box. In March, Californians will consider their relationship with a mountain lion, or cougar, when they go to vote. Hunting cougars was banned in 1972. The ban was reaffirmed by voters in a proposition which passed by statewide referendum in 1990. It issued today is a new proposition, number 197, which would repeal the special protection of mountain lions under California law. Joining us are California Senator Tim Leslie, who co-wrote the ballot measure, and Paul Van Dyke, supervisor of the No on 197 campaign. Locking horns over the question, should California voters pass Proposition 197, which will change the special protection of the mountain lion under California law? Senator Leslie?
California's balance of nature is out of balance. The population of mountain lions has grown so much they are killing livestock, pets, endangered species, and unfortunately, even humans. In 1972, there were only 4 depredation permits issued in California in the entire year. This past year, there were over 360 issued. That's one a day. Opponents attack this measure as a sport hunting issue. They are deliberately lying to you. It is not. It is a public safety issue, and that's why it's supported by law enforcement, as well as cattlemen, sheep growers, and victim groups.
Mr. Van Dyke.
Well, we call Proposition 197 the trophy hunting proposition. Proposition 197 is a fraud. It legalizes trophy hunting of mountain lions, while the words sport or trophy hunting are cleverly omitted from the measure. You know, 1990 voters passed a ban on trophy hunting of mountain lions, and this measure will overturn it. But the backers know, and the backers, which are the National Rifle Association, the California Rifle and Pistol Association, Safari Club International, all working to raise money for this initiative. They know that if the voters understand that this measure legalizes the sport hunting of mountain lions, it will lose. So they wrote a bill that never mentions legalizing sport hunting, but that's exactly what it does.
Senator Leslie in reply.
The mountain lion is a real problem for rural and suburban California. This is not about sport hunting. It is about public safety. Children in the urban areas are afraid to play in their yards due to drive-by shootings. In rural areas, parents can't let their children play outside for fear of mountain lion attack. We are asking our urban friends to please help us. Vote yes on Proposition 197.
Paul Van Dyke in reply.
This is a gun lobby attempt to use fear and scare tactics to scare the voters into legalizing the trophy hunting of mountain lions. They claim that wildlife officials need to manage mountain lions. We agree. The fact is that we've supported legislation to force Department of Fish and Game to protect the public. The measures we've supported toughen law enforcement officials' power to kill mountain lions on the spot whenever the public is threatened. But the gun lobby backers of Proposition 197 have opposed those moves because they preserve the 1990 voter-approved ban on sport hunting of mountain lions.
Thank you, gentlemen. We've been joined by State Senator Tim Leslie, co-author of Ballot Proposition 197, and Paul Van Dyke, campaign supervisor of the No on 197 campaign. I'm Peter Burley. We're always interested in what you have to say, so write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206, or reach us by email. We appreciate all of you who have done so already. Our address is envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or visit us on the World Wide Web at www.wamc.org/env. That's www.wamc.org/env. Next week, we'll explain how you can hear the Environment Show at any time via our webpage and the internet on your personal computer. Still ahead, our ear to the ground Linda Anderson shows how one university is working to become a sustainable community. And our Earth Calendar will explore the secret world of winter, where frogs are frozen and birds still search for mates. These stories still ahead on the Environment Show.
Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, environmental economics at Rutgers University. Rutgers is a large university with 47,000 students and over 17,000 faculty and staff. Like many other universities, it is a self-contained and closed environment. Because of this, Kevin Lyons, purchasing officer at Rutgers, saw a unique opportunity to create an environmentally sensitive and sustainable system he calls an environmental economic effort.
The whole idea, the whole program, is that we are trying to make a Rutgers University oasis of sorts, being responsible for our own waste. Instead of the previous practices of procuring all these products and services and such, and then shipping them off to the landfill or to wherever, and then basically just losing track of what happens with our waste. What we want to do is just take ownership, I guess you could say, of all the materials, and then find avenues, whether it's to designated markets or to research or to areas where it could be reused. So, in a sense, creating our own little network or environment.
From his position as purchaser, Lyons began restructuring contracts. He eliminated those contractors that were environmentally insensitive and replaced them with new contractors that were willing to help meet the university's environmental goals. By doing extensive research, he found vendors who used, or were willing to use, more environmentally sensitive packaging and recycled parts. Lyons says due to the competitive nature of bidding for a large university contract, environmental goals have been well met, and the campus has experienced substantial savings.
At Rutgers University, it cost extremely more, or it costs a lot more to landfill than it does to recycle. And with that in mind, the more that we can pull out of the landfill waste stream and divert it towards recycling or reuse, we're in a sense reducing the amount of money that we're spending on landfill waste.
With a goal of achieving total sustainability, Lyons and Rutgers are working towards a closed-loop system.
We term that to be, we're in total control of what we're actually bringing on the campus, whether it's recycled content products or any products that we need to do our daily operations here at the school. And then making sure that once those products have served their entire usefulness on the campus, that there's some place for that product to go, whether it's to be recycled or whether it can be re-entered into the various research outlets that we have here on campus. We're also looking at using waste products at the university to help sustain other products.
Products like ceiling tiles, park benches, speed bumps, or spray bottles. Lyons has conducted a number of workshops and lectures on creating environmentally sensitive contracts, and many institutions have shown interest, such as the Meadowlands Sports Complex in New Jersey. And this is just what Rutgers is hoping for, that others will duplicate their efforts and further a responsibility to affect positive environmental change worldwide. With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
Let's look at our Earth calendar. We're well into the first month of the year, and the East has been through the blizzard of 96, subsequent snows, and bitter, bitter cold. Stan Tequila, naturalist and author of Nature Smart, A Family Guide to Nature, tells us that even in the Northeast, where probably the worst of the cold is yet to come, birds are stirring in anticipation of warmer days, which snow-shoveling humans don't even imagine.
I was just out yesterday, and the downy woodpeckers and hairy woodpeckers are already drumming on resonant logs. These are logs that are kind of hollowed, and they make a loud noise when they bang on them. And so they get up there, and they're not drilling for a home, or they're not drilling for insects. They're drilling for territories and to attract a mate. So already here in January, we've got these birds setting up territories and already calling out for mates and trying to pair up for the year.
In contrast, the tree frog has a chemical reaction to winter, which means it's pretty passive at this time of year.
The tree frogs are frogs that, when they hibernate, they get down just underneath the leaf litter, maybe an inch or two under the soil, underneath a log or behind some bark on a tree. And then they go through a really complex chemical change in their body where each individual cell swaps out the water that's in the cell and replaces it with a glycerol or a glycol-type substance, almost like an antifreeze. And that stops the freezing, because what would happen if it didn't do that, if the water inside the cell froze, the little ice crystals would rupture each individual cell and consequently kill that cell and obviously kill the frog. Well, what they do is they pump in this glycol. It lowers their freezing temperature. But now the modern or the recent studies that they're showing that these types of frogs are actually freezing parts of their body. I just read one study that showed 30% of the frog, of the individual frog, freezes. And I read another one where it said actually 70% of the individual frog freezes. So leaving, the question, how do they do this? You know, how do they actually freeze and then come springtime when they thaw out, come back to life? And that's something that's almost science fiction. I mean, it's certainly something we can't reproduce. Cryogenics is something that we always talk about, but science fiction, but it just doesn't happen.
And so if midwinter inspires you either to call for a mate like a songbird or pickle yourself like a tree frog, you will be celebrating instincts which are reflected in the biodiversity which is all around us. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 316. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.